but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Well, this show takes itself very seriously. Sports radio, darn it. We need to take ourselves very seriously. For example, on yesterday's program, we had on a long-time legendary high school football coach in the state of Oregon, Steve Corey. He's been at it a whole long time. Talked about his players having to, quote-unquote, dress down for the game. Now, I happen to think it should be dress up for the game. They're putting on uniforms. You're getting dressed up. You're going somewhere. You can argue you're dressing down all you want. I maintain you're dressing up. I had a lot of BFT listeners wrestling with this after the show yesterday. A couple slipped into my DMs. Now, somebody in the DMs said, you know, when you go to warm up at a game, you are dressing down. But you are suiting up for the game. I still am not clear what we're doing. I think you're dressing up. Steven says you're dressing down. My 7th grade PE coach, may he rest in peace, Coach McConnon, he used to say dress down. But I feel like it was one of those things that came, that was born from like the 1950s. Everybody dress down to your PE shorts. And was there a more intimidating experience than being like a middle school kid in a PE class that was basically a cattle call with a coach at that time? I am sure they don't do this anymore because you'd get people arrested. I am sure they don't do this. But in our PE classes, at the first day of school, they said you're required to take a shower at the end of the PE class. You are required. And what happened was about 140 of us in this PE class were like, how are we all going to turn on the shower? And then the minute Coach McConnon turns his back, quickly change into our regular clothes and run out the door. Because nobody wanted to shower after PE class. This is not like being at the gym, okay, in your 70s. This was like being a middle school kid and you were like, I don't need a shower. I just need to get onto my next class. I'm happy to say, me and my friends and our classmates, I don't think any of us ever took a shower after PE class in the middle school. And I'm sure they don't do it now. Steven, you got a coach in your family. Are they showering after PE class these days? I don't think so.
I don't think so, no. I think that it does seem a little like a little weird nowadays. That
it is weird. Hey, bunch of kids, all you guys get into the shower.
Requirement.
Right now. Make sure you scrub up in there. Like, this is, you know, it feels like you'd get somebody in trouble even suggesting such a thing. My PE coach, and he was a throwback. He looked like he should be wearing Chuck Taylor sneakers. And I had him down to be like 60 or 70 years old at the time. But the truth is he was probably in his 40s. And I saw people differently. You know how when you're younger, you see people at a different age. And I later found out Coach McConnon had a big, giant heart. And I didn't know it at the time because he came off as rather stern. And I can remember, first of all, he wanted everybody to shower, which was out of the question for me as a seventh grader. I was scared enough being in that prison that they called a middle school. You know, it was a rough school. My first day of school, I saw some fights. I saw some things I'd never seen before. Kids were fighting. There was gang stuff going on. I thought to myself, do I need to belong to a crew while I'm in here in my 2 years I was doing in seventh and eighth grade? But Coach McConnon on the first day said, all right, you know, everybody got that white Hanes T-shirt, pair of green shorts. And then he said, I want you all to put your first name on your shirt in a Sharpie and we had to wear that shirt every day, as I mentioned. And then, you know, because my last name was Canzano, I happened to be right next to Campos. And at my school, there were like four Camposes in that PE class. And then Coach McConnon said, line up alphabetically. And so the Campos kids, who were all, you know, may or may not have been cousins, they all had to not only line up alphabetically by their last name, they hadn't had to go to their first name. And so, you know, here I was standing next to Uvaldo Campos for 2 years in my PE class. And it was interesting to go through that. And then here came Coach McConnon. He also said, go get a lock for your locker and get a master lock. He said that on day one. Now, I don't know if he was getting a kickback from master lock or what, but he said, I don't want you getting one of these knockoff locks. There's a lock called a Slaymaker out there. If I ever see a Slaymaker, I'm going to knock it off your locker. And sure enough, somebody came to school with a Slaymaker, Stephen, the very next day and locked up their PE clothes against the advice of Coach McConnon. And we all gathered around as Coach McConnon took his shoe off and knocked that Slaymaker right off the locker onto the floor, scattered in pieces. Again, something you couldn't do today if you were a coach, because somebody's parent would be suing the school saying, hey, you embarrassed my kid by knocking their Slaymaker lock off their shoe, off the locker with the shoe. And I never forget it. The guy was legend. But I found out later what a good heart he had. You know, the middle school that I went to had a children's home that was located directly across the street from the junior high school. We were only 7th and 8th grade, so it really wasn't a middle school. It was a true junior high. And this children's home, we always kind of walked by it. Like, maybe if you got dropped off at school, you'd walk by this children's home and you'd think, you know, gosh, what, it looks scary. It looks imposing. It was this big old building, had a big gate around it. And the kids that would come in and out of there, you know, you realize now the kids that were coming in and out of there were orphaned, or the kids coming in and out of there had parents who were in prison, or they had really rough circumstances where they were not adopted and had no family members. And so you had some kids in there that were that needed a lot of love and needed some help. And I don't know it as a seventh grader, though, but I know that there was an older kid, an eighth grader, who was named Mike McDonald. And Mike McDonald was a really good athlete and a really good basketball player. And Coach McConnon kind of took him under his wing as a seventh or eighth grader. And Coach McConnon and his wife later adopted Mike McDonald. Mike McDonald went on to be a high school basketball coach and a college coach. And I think to this day, looks over at Coach McConnon and says, hey, that guy saved my life. Look, he stepped in. He wasn't just a coach. He became a father figure. And I'll never forget that. There's so many good teachers out there that are fighting the good fight, who are doing good things and stepping up. And I think, you know, that Mike McDonald kid was just such a hardworking kid, good classmate, good, you know, obviously a good student and a good athlete. But I'll never forget Coach McConnon stepping up with he and his wife. They adopted the kid, Stephen. I mean, you see that all the time. You married an educator. You know that they're not in it for the money. They're not in it really for the summers off either. I mean, you got to love kids if you're in that role.
100%, yeah. And you know what? And that's the thing is, when I was in school, you know, I couldn't recognize what kids were struggling. Probably like you, it's very difficult to figure out. Hey, that kid has a bad home life and stuff like that. And then as you get older, and as my wife is a teacher and a coach, she shares stories that she hears from these children, and it's heartbreaking. And like when I was a kid, John, I didn't want to go to school. Like, I'm like, man, I got to go to school. Like, this sucks. I'd rather just stay home. Like, some kids, their best part of the day is going to school because they don't want to be home because their home life is so bad. And so the teachers recognize this, and they make it as comfortable as they can for these kids while also trying to mold them into, you know, compatible parts of a society. Because look, you want to break that cycle. You don't want them to grow up and then have their own children and have their own home life where they're ruining their kids' life. So it's such a touchy subject, and it's so hard. And you're right. These teachers, man, they go through a lot. They sacrifice a lot from their families to help these kids out. And it is cool to see, like, anytime we go out to Clackamas, because that's where Coach Vaughn's from, that's where she went to high school, that's where she coached and taught for a long time, she's going to see at least seven people that know her and will go out of their way to say, you know, hey, well, how's it going? You know, I really miss you, all that kind of stuff. So it's cool to see the payoff like that. But yeah, they sacrificed a ton.
I think, too, you hit on something there with, like, you know, we always say as adults, you see this stuff now that adults will put, like, you know, you don't know who's struggling out there. You don't know what they're going through. You don't know what someone else is going through. You don't know what kind of day they're having. You don't know what's going on at home. You don't know what, you know, they're dealing with financially or psychologically or socially or, you know, in their own family or with their health. You don't really know. I think it's especially hard for kids because I can remember being at that age. And 100% now that I look back and I go, gosh, man, there were some kids I was growing up with that really had difficult circumstances. You know, they were being raised by a single parent, or they had, you know, serious health issues, or there were some economic issues that, you know, obviously to me now, but not so much when I was in it as a kid. And, you know, as a kid, you're just so, you're kind of oblivious a little bit to what other people are going through. You're worried enough as a seventh or an eighth grader or a high school kid. You're worried enough about, you know, am I wearing the right thing? Am I doing the right thing? Am I playing the right sport? Am I paying attention? Like, you can barely stay on top of your own business at that age because the world is evolving and you don't have the fully developed, fully formed brain. But I look back now and I think about kids that were maybe some of the mean kids in school. And I look back and I think about it and I'm like, man, those kids must have really been struggling. A couple of those kids must have been struggling. And, or you look back and you see kids that spent all their time at the school, and you hit on this. Like, there are some kids who maybe aren't getting fed at home, or maybe their home life is crazy. And the only kind of sanity they get is when they go into the structure of the school system and they're around teachers and people who care about them and their friends. And, you know, and they stay, you know, these are the kids who you might see kids who are super involved, who end up playing multiple sports, and they're high, you know, they're active in a lot of things. And everybody goes, oh, those kids have it all figured out. And a lot of them are trying to escape, or some of them are trying to escape from what is going on. And I'll tell you this, like, you know, we will now, between now and the end of the year, do a fundraiser here on the show for the Baldfaced Truth Foundation. Because in part because you guys are part and parcel, you know, owners of that foundation. You've been here. If you've been a listener, you know what that foundation's trying to do. It's trying to help kids and schools and you know, look, we'll between now and the end of the year do a fundraiser here, or do a radiothon of some function here on the show. But if you just want to check that out and support kids, you can go to baldfacedtruth.org. You can make a donation at any time. And you know, there were a couple of donations that I saw that came in today from people wanting to help kids and be involved. But I thought about it yesterday when Steve Corey was on the show, because he was talking about all the different athletes that put in the time and the effort and the energy that are part of his program. And he's playing this 6A division high school semifinal playoff game on Friday night. But the truth is, like, you know, the OSAA rules say he can't suit up more than 60 kids. And he's going, you know, why am I not allowed to do that? It seems kind of silly that I don't get to suit up the kids. And I joke about, like, is it dress down, dress up? You know, is what is it? And I did get an answer late yesterday from the OSAA. I'll just read it here. And I think, you know, look, I love being the conduit for this kind of stuff because, you know, Peter Weber at the OSAA reached out to me, and it's been a really tough week in their office. They had one of their longtime employees pass away on Sunday after a battle with cancer. And so, you know, the people at OSAA are geared on, you know, making the playoffs happen this week, but they're also grieving. But, you know, Peter told me that, you know, it stems from the idea of, you know, consistency and equity. Now, tell me if you understand this or if this makes sense to you. Home teams may be able to roll out 80 kids, right? All the kids in their program. But if you have a team that's traveling from like 150 miles away or 300 miles away and staying overnight, they may not be able to do that. There's also a reimbursement formula. Some of the sports, basketball and volleyball, you have an issue with the team area and, you know, how many kids can you have on the bench. But Peter Weber told me This has been adjusted over time. The 60 limit has been the same for a few years. They also, you know, put that out at the beginning of the year, and they tell the schools you can rotate your 60 between the games. So, you know, if you have 80 kids, you can rotate. Like, if, let's say you have 10 spots of kids that you just kind of are interchangeable, you can rotate the 60. It doesn't have to be the same 60 every week, but they didn't think it was equitable for, you know, a school that maybe can afford to send 80 kids on the road versus one that can't. I don't know. Where do you stand on that? Because I come back and I go, okay, if that's the case, like, you know, if it's just a travel thing, can't the schools make that decision themselves? Like, why penalize the schools that have 80 kids and can afford to travel those 80 kids? I don't know. Steven, where do you fall on that?
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it should be school dependent. Like, if the school can get as many kids as they want out there, I think that's great, because if you don't allow them to dress up as many kids as they want to, as they can, you're just taking away from the experience of the actual athletes. And isn't that what sports is supposed to be about? The memories, about the experiences. Like, for some of these kids, they may never get on a varsity football field, like never be able to play, but they can say, look, you know, when they're 35 years old and their grandpa, they're telling their grandkids, look, I got to play in the state title game. When I was at Lake Oswego, we were, you know, semifinals against Nelson High School, and we went up against them. Like, he'll be able to say that. And I think for a lot of kids, you know, high school sports may be the best memory that they have in their athletic career. So why are you taking that away from them if the school is legitimately able to bring them along and it's not a big deal? It's not causing any type of problems. You know, these kids are just having fun on the field. Like, I don't understand what the big deal is. If the school is, you know, if the school can adequately.
Is that not equitable? I mean, but think about it. I mean, Lake Oswego High School can afford to do this. Let's say they're playing, you know, Joe McGee High School, that's from an area that's not as affluent. And that school is going, gosh, we could barely afford to travel 60. We go to play this game. We show up, and Lake Oswego's got 80 kids on the other side of the field.
I guess it could be like an intimidation thing. Like,
I don't know. How about from a basketball standpoint? You know, I don't really see the difference between 13 or 15 or 16. I don't really think, like, what's the big deal? Like, put an extra chair there.
I don't either, but I will say I do think for basketball you do need to cut it off at some point, because I think that...
What's the number then?
I do think like 12 to 13 is the number.
13 is the number now. Would you go higher? Would you go 15?
No, I think 15 is too much.
15 kids suited up for a basketball game?
Because at the same time, like, look, I want these kids to have these experiences, but I don't want to hand out, you know, participation trophies to everybody. Like, yeah, you do have to earn it to be on that field. And as Coach said yesterday, John, like, these kids practice every day with the varsity team. Like, they're out there working their
tails
off.
Yeah, that was important, because he said they all season long these kids have practiced.
Right, and so they're literally part of the team. That's why I have a problem with it. Where if you're just saying, hey, I'm going to call up some JV guys for the basketball playoffs, like, I think that's a little bit different than what this situation is.
Because I do see the advantage of calling some guys up, because you want them to get a taste, right? You know, we want continuity. We want to bring our good sophomores up and have them suit up, stand on the sideline for the game, be on the bench, so that when they get there as a junior, they know what the heck it's about. It won't be the first time they've done it. And so I get that. I see it, but I also see, though, the point of the OSAA going, you know, there's an equity thing here. I kind of fall on the spectrum of, we all know there's an imbalance when a school like Lake Oswego, and I'm not picking on Lake Oswego, but let's just say, you know, it's a more affluent
suburb. We all know that.
Yeah, we all know when Lake Oswego or Westland or Jesuit or Central show up for a game, there's more funding there. Don't we know that?
I went to Putnam, and when I was in school, I was 4A with Lake Oswego, with Lake Ridge, with all these schools. Like, yes, I know. Like, there is a big difference between going to Rex Putnam and a difference of going to Lake Oswego money-wise.
Okay, and so if we're doing that, are we just kind of pretending it doesn't exist when we say there's a cap at 60, and then you know, Steve Corey over at Lake Oswego's buying tickets for his extra 20 kids to sit in the stands? Or, you know, if the game's at Providence Park, I heard years ago when Corey played for the championship at Providence Park, he marched those extra 20 kids down the ramp and let them kind of stand there on the edge of the ramp just to kind of watch from there. Like, I don't think we're I don't think that we're sending a great message by saying, hey, if you're part of the team, that's great. Be part of the team all year, except when it comes to the playoffs, and then we have to be equitable when it comes to the playoffs. You want to talk about equity, you know, look at the teams that are playing in the 6A division for the semifinals and beyond. It is West Lynn against Central Catholic. It is Nelson High School and Lake Oswego. Okay, like something happening there, don't you think? Like, don't you think there's an equity thing going on there anyway? Like, if you want to address the equity thing, you know, maybe there should be, like, these games are being decided decades ago when you were born into a family that could afford to live in a certain area. Like, you know, that's what we're talking about, really. Come on, what are we talking about?
No, you're 100% right. Like, I know from experience, like, anytime we faced off against one of these teams, it's like, man, like, it's already, not only do you have better players, you have more expensive things, like, everything about it is, you know, it's the David versus Goliath type of thing, but you gotta battle through it, and you are right. Like, if you're born into it, you're born into it. You're just a lucky person.
Well, and I don't, here's the other thing, like, I was under no illusion. Like, my oldest daughter went to LaSalle High School, okay? It's a private school. It's not cheap. It, you know, she went to LaSalle and she played volleyball. And I can remember talking to her high school coach at the time and saying, hey, you know, they're suiting up for a volleyball game and they're playing Park Rose. Park Rose had really good athletes, really good players, except the LaSalle kids had been in the club system for years and years and years and years and years. All right. And a lot of the volleyball skills are skills that you hone and learn and develop as a 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old playing club basketball. And I was standing there next to the court, and the coach for LaSalle was standing with me and warming up. And I said to him, I said, this game got decided 10 years ago. And he looked at me, he goes, what do you mean? And I said, 10 years ago, when the parents of the kids on our side of the bench could afford to send a 9-year-old, 10-year-old off to play $3,000 season in club basketball, the access point there, that was the determining factor for the game that's about to be played today. Because if you had given me the same kids that were on the Park Rose side and you had said to me, hey, let me get to them at 9 and put them in a club program where they're going to travel around, they're going to get the best coaching, they're going to get their skills developed, that Park Rose team would have dominated. And so it made me kind of sad in a way, because I was like, you know, we got to change this. And I've talked a lot with local you know, there's a couple local coaches in particular, Marshall Cho, who is a basketball coach, former Lakewood coach. He has made it kind of a mission of his own where he wants to go out and put on camps and clinics for all kids, not just for kids in affluent suburbs who can learn to play basketball. And Marshall Cho might be the best basketball coach in the state of Oregon. You know, he's a guy who should be sitting on an NBA or a WNBA bench as an assistant coach right now, former University of Portland assistant. He coaches the international team as part of the Nike Hoop Summit. He is the guy, right? If you want your kid working with a private coach, it's Marshall Cho. That's who you send him to go work on the side. And he, you know, he's really interested in having access for kids. And so he no longer is the coach at Lake Ridge. He's kind of doing his own thing. He's running open gyms. He's running clinics and camps. You know, I've talked to him about the BFT Foundation maybe helping underwrite some of those camps, because we'd love to get access for kids who maybe want and have a real desire to be like a really good player, but they just don't have a parent who can afford to go pay $100 an hour to go get a private coach. And so Marshall has stepped up in that way. And then there's a volleyball coach, Coach Chijo, who is kind of doing the same thing. He's left the structure of the club sports scene. He's all over Instagram. He's become an Instagram sensation. And he's just going, I just want to teach kids how to play volleyball, and regardless of whether or not their parents can afford a private lesson or not. And so I think we need more of that. I think we need more of that out there. And I think we need more access for kids that maybe, you know, just have that hunger and that desire. And, you know, I'm as guilty as anybody. Like, my kids have opportunities that other kids don't. But I'm not stupid. I'm looking out at the court, and I'm seeing it on game day, and I'm going, well, this game was decided a decade ago. Let's go to the phone lines. Mike's in Portland. Go ahead, Mike. You're on.
Hey, John, man, I'm not to disagree with you.
Okay.
About rich kids versus poor kids. First of all, when Nike wanted to build a brand, they went into the ghetto. They didn't go into suburbia. They went to the disadvantaged kids because that's where the talent was.
Yeah. And then what did they do? And then what did Nike do?
They got those kids
that were great athletes, and they put them in their club system, their AAU system. They got them the best coaches. I think we agree, Mike. I think I'm saying that the suburban kids who are more affluent are winning those games not because they're better athletes, but just because they've been in this club system where they get private training and they've got access to coaching and training that other kids don't.
I disagree with you, but John, I got to bring up something about this myth in football or sports in general. This about a meritocracy.
Okay,
I think that's a myth, and I can look at Shedeur Sanders and how he's being treated as a prime example that it's not based on talent; it's based on other things. So. My point is that meritocracy doesn't exist. And another point, John, I want to illustrate my point.
Okay.
There are 32 coaches in the NFL. 32 coaches. And out of that group, only 9 of them are black. Where's the meritocracy there? Also, in the NBA, there's 30 head coaches, and only 11 of them are black. Where's the meritocracy there? Especially when the majority of the players are black.
There were 16 NBA coaches who are black in 2023. Mike is right. There are only 11 now, which is just over, a third of the league's coaches. Some people call that progress. I would be curious to see and hear what other people think. And look, in the state of Oregon, there is a Rooney Rule that requires the schools at Oregon and Oregon State, public schools that receive public funding, to interview a minority candidate. Oregon State, subject to that rule and that law, they must interview a minority candidate. And I know that Jamarcus Shepherd, who is Alabama assistant, has interviewed this week. And so Oregon State will say, okay, we're compliant. But I actually think maybe I'm naive, that I feel like we have moved beyond it being just, let's check the box. I think Jamarcus Shepherd is one of the leading candidates at Oregon State. I don't know if he's going to get the job. I think that might have more to do with Trent Bray, because Shepherd has never been a head coach, and Bray had never been a head coach, and Oregon State might be a little skittish there, but we shall see. Let's go one more call. Paul is called in from West Lynn. Go ahead, Paul.
John, this is just a continuation of the common theme over the past few months about inequities financially in sports. I mean, you got the Portland State coach and athletic director who you can't get a hold of, but the president, why can't Portland State be competitive? Why can't Oregon State be competitive? They don't have the money. If you got private equity going into the Big Ten or the Big 12, Big Ten, I should say.
Yeah.
This is what it's become. Money and greed has destroyed sports. And it's so unfortunate because it trickles down. It starts at the pros, goes down to college. You see in high school, and you're right, it's where the money is. That's where the high schools are that are dominant all the time, in the basketball, in baseball, in football. The endurance sports, it's a little different, but you don't need the feeder systems. But it always comes down to money, and it's just become even more heightened in 2025, I feel.
Yeah, look, your follow the money becomes the age-old thing. Rick Neuheisel, as he said last week to me, we were talking, and I started to ask questions, and he said, well, the answer is money. And he said, what's the question? that's it. The answer is money. What's the question? We got a great radio show for you. John Platt, Stanford broadcaster, coming up here next. Plus, later in the program, you'll hear from Joe Lohrig, the Oregon Ducks special teams coach. It's a fantastic interview. I taped it with Lohrig earlier today. You're going to want to hear it. Stick around. You got the BFT.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
we've got John Platts, who you can hear on the Stanford basketball and Stanford football broadcast, former Stanford athlete himself, author and historian and resident expert right there on the Stanford campus. John Platts joining us. It is a big week because the big game is taking place. Cal, Stanford should be a good one. Platts, what's the atmosphere around the campus?
Well, first of all, good to talk to you, John. Thanks for checking in with your roots here in the Bay Area. 128th big game coming up on Saturday. It's the, as it happens, it's the 43rd anniversary of the play, November 20th, 1982. Not that I'm bitter or anything, but I was at the game. And you do, you know, they bring it up on local radio here, and otherwise I probably wouldn't have remembered it. But no, it's Stanford Cal, and it's still going strong. I think it helps, John, that the two schools are still in the same conference. Look, we all miss the fact that it's not a Pac-12 game, but it's still, you know, the blue and the gold and the cardinal and the white going at it on Sunday.
The Stanford program is kind of in a transitional period. Andrew Luck coming into the fold. He brought his old coach that he trusts, Frank Reich, into the mix as well. How has the Reich era this season been to observe?
He's been terrific, John. I mean, it's been good for me to get exposure to a former NFL coach and a high level one, right? He was the offensive coordinator of that Eagles team that won the Super Bowl, I want to say in 2016, 2017, in that period. And of course was the Colts head coach and the Panthers head coach and got spit out by the NFL, even though he was 500 for his career. It's just, that's how tough it is in the NFL. Now Johnny's a football guy, but I think he's been energized by the experience. I think at first he just said yes to Andrew because of their really good relationship and sort of concluded, well, I'll figure it out as I go. My family's on the East Coast in the Carolinas, but I'll come out West and I'll figure this thing out. And I think he's been energized by the Stanford kids. You know, he's running the NFL offense and, you know, the ACC is a grind, particularly defensive lines the last month for Stanford. And I think Stanford stumbled in that opener against Hawaii. Otherwise, Stanford, the talk I think with Stanford would be that this game, or Stanford might have been playing for a bowl game here in November. Of course, they're not now with only three wins. But Frank has been good. I think he's enjoyed it. I think he's been kind of pleasantly surprised by the Stanford kids. It's not really a portal group. I mean, there's 17 transfers, but it's not, you know, 30 or 40 like some other schools have. So I think it's been good all the way around. Frank's just coached the team. Andrew's handled the recruiting.
The Andrew Luck involvement. Do you expect it to continue? It looks to me like he's having fun. He's out trying to sell season tickets. He's talking to fans and recruits. He seems like he's rolled his sleeves up.
John, you're underselling it. He loves his job. I mean, I think he's enjoying it more than even he envisioned. This was not part of his plan. He and his wife, he'd come back to the Bay Area to do graduate school, John, at the School of Education, just because he thought he wanted to get into teaching or coaching or nonprofit work. And this sort of came up about this time last year. And Andrew, you know, is a loyal soldier. He, you know, didn't like what was going on with the program, the successive three win seasons. And, you know, he said yes to President John Levin's call. And, you know, Johnny's everywhere. I mean, he's on the field during practice. He's energized with recruits. Yes, he does donor stuff. Yes, he's boning up on the NIL. Stanford's added in the athletic department Shane Scobe, John. I know you know the name, the defensive player that broke a heart or two at the University of Oregon in the early 2010s. Scobe worked at McKinsey for a half dozen years, and now he's in the athletic department, I think, to help with NIL stuff. So some of the old crew is back, but Andrew is at the center of it. And you can see in his eyes, Sean, he is enthused by this, and he's determined to fix Stanford football. Now, it's going to be challenging. It's not a sure thing, not at all. But if there's a guy to do it, it's Andrew Luck. And again, I've been surprised by how much he loves the work.
I am talking with John Platts, Stanford radio, basketball and football, former Stanford athlete, author of 100 years of Stanford history, and certainly a guy interested in the big game as Stanford and Cal will play this weekend. Andrew Luck, if he calls me and I'm a if I'm a Stanford fan, my phone rings and it's Andrew Luck asking me to buy season tickets, I'm buying season tickets. Like, the fact that he's willing to pick up the phone and do that kind of stuff is incredible.
Well, he's not a big time guy, John. Not at all. I mean, you're right. He did that with season ticket holders whom he didn't know, just people who were on the list, because he wants to see the crowds at Stanford Stadium come back up. I mean, winning will help with that as well. But I mean, Andrew is all in, John. He identifies personally with the role. I mean, that helps in any job, right? When you just feel like this job is me, and every facet of this job is Andrew. I mean, he was into his studies. He was an architecture major. So he sort of gets the whole Stanford thing and has an eye for who could coach them, John, and the student athletes that would fit, right? Not everybody fits, but, you know, the guy who wants to get the top dollar or play at three different schools, that's not the Stanford model. And that's not what the administrators or the alumni want. And Andrew is on board with that. So, Andrew, he'll dust the floor, John. I mean, he's all about turning this thing around, and whatever the task requires, he's going to do it.
John, the football itself, this is, we watched Ben Gulbranson at Oregon State. We've seen him a little bit at Stanford. The offense seems like it has struggled at times to generate yards and points. Where are they at right now with playing maybe their best football of the season, or at what point was Stanford playing its best football?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's sort of oscillated between offense and defense, John. You know, you can appreciate this. The ACC schedule, you're playing seven other teams, and there's a whole bunch of teams you're not playing. Last year, it seemed like Stanford faced all the great quarterback teams big margin losses. This year, Stanford's played teams, John, that had great, great defensive lines in front seven. I mean, Bill Belichick, the most recent game for Stanford 2 weeks ago at North Carolina, they got some kid from Delaware that was a sack machine. I mean, Elijah Brown, who's the new quarterback for Stanford, Frank Reich having made a switch from Ben Gulbranson to Elijah Brown, who's a sophomore. Well, Elijah Brown was sacked nine times in the game against North Carolina 2 weeks ago. And the whole month, John, has been sort of Stanford pockets collapsing and quarterbacks trying to escape, you know, really good pass rush. So, I think right now the defense actually has surprised to the upside. Statistically, and to my eyes, the offense has struggled. But I think the good news for Stanford fans is, this week you're not playing Miami. You're not playing SMU. You're not playing that Pitt team of Pat Narduzzi that has all those creative blitzes. You're playing Cal, and that's a Justin Wilcox coach team, which is sound, but they don't have the NIL stars, particularly on the defensive line, that Stanford has faced in the last month.
The Belichick thing, how weird was that to look down in a game where your team's playing and Bill Belichick is on the sideline?
Well, yeah, I have to admit, my eyes don't always lock on to the opposing coach because it's just, another person across the sideline. But if it's Belichick, you find your eyes looking there. He's got a couple former players and NFL guys on the staff. Jimmy Collins, a linebacker, is a linebacker coach. And Andrew does a pregame show with us, and we were talking about that and the staff that Belichick has put together. But, I mean, John, it's not easy. I mean, Belichick, they got beat by Wake Forest last week, and I think they're 4-6, I want to say. It could be 5-5, but yeah. It's been tough for the ball coach.
I am looking at Cal. They are, having kind of a decent season, a little up and down, but decent. They got the win over Louisville a couple weeks ago. They have to feel good about that. What would beating Cal mean for the Stanford program this season?
Be enormous. It would be enormous. Beating Cal is a goal, a big goal. It sounds hokey, but it really is kind of imbued in all the guys. And again, Andrew's part of that too. He's all on board with the rivalry game. And John, it goes back to 1892, so it does have some meaning. But also, John, I mean, Stanford is sitting at 3-7. Stanford has been 3-9 the last 4 years. So just getting to that fourth game, that fourth W, is tangible. Is a tangible sign of progress, and it's a winnable game. I mean, you can. Lots of ways to analyze it, and JKS, the quarterback for Cal, he's great, as you and I have sort of communicated previously, and so that's good. It's going to be tough, but Stanford brings some things to the game, and I do think being battle tested these last 4 weeks or 4 or 5 weeks, particularly on the road, and getting some guys back is going to make Stanford a pretty competitive foe for the Golden Bears at Stanford Stadium on Saturday.
I am interested too in kind of the future of Stanford, a $50 million donation coming into the athletic department, that helps. You know, it seems like as though there are some people in that Stanford community who really get that, like, hey, there are some disadvantages here with the portal and NIL that Stanford's got to shore up. How are you feeling kind of about the momentum right now and that donation? How loud was that in your world?
Well, it's louder than anybody's world, John. I mean, that $50 million is a lot for a college football program. I mean, Brad Freeman, the donor from the Los Angeles area, former Stanford player in the early 60s, he's been connected with the program and philanthropy, you know, going back several years. But look, John, it helps. I think, you know, you look at Stanford, and I think, John, you know this, having been raised and worked in the Bay Area, Jim Plunkett is as much a front porch person for Stanford as anybody. I mean, he and Condoleezza Rice probably are the two most recognizable, the two most active in on campus and even off campus official events, fundraising, what have you. So football has always been a big deal, John. The first year the university was founded, football was a big deal. I mean, the administrators prioritized it. And, you know, Walter Camp coached at Stanford in the 1890s and Pop Warner in the 1920s. And it's just been, you know, up and down, John. The peaks have been pretty darn high. And a lot of people, and not just football players, John, don't want to see football, you know, relegated, becoming, you know, in a worst case Division III or something. Remember, Jay Berwanger won a Heisman for the University of Chicago, and that's now a Division III school. So, you know, I think the administration has gotten the message that football is a big thing for sort of Stanford's brand, not necessarily that you have to win national championships and there's going to be turnover if nothing happens, but to have it be prominent, to be able to play competitively with the big boys, and have football be relevant and out front at Stanford is front and center. And again, that's why Andrew Luck is the perfect human being on this planet to be trying to resuscitate the program and the brand.
John Platt's with us, Stanford football. I'm excited about the big game. You know, what has to go right for Stanford to win and upset Cal?
Well, I think the way I look at it, John, I mean, JKS, right? Jeron Kiave Songo-Polotele. I mean, he's a future NFL player, maybe a future Heisman Trophy winner, but he's not the most mobile guy in the world. I think Stanford's defensive line, which is the oldest position group on the team, and they have some solid players, not superstars, but they got some solid players. If Stanford can get after Songo-Polotele or get him off the spot, John, make him throw on the run. Duke sacked JKS six times in a game in Berkeley that I happened to go to. Stanford had a bye that week, John, and Duke won by, I want to say, 20 points in the game. So I think the key for Stanford is making Songo-Polotele uncomfortable, get him off the spot, make him, you know, rush throws, maybe you get a turnover or two, because the young man can be prone to that if he's, I think, pressured. So I think pressuring Songo-Polotele to the extent Stanford can is a big deal. On the Stanford side, John, it's run the football. Stanford has a couple of effective backs. The stats don't show it, and again, it's partly because Stanford has been running into buzzsaws like that Miami defensive line that has a couple of NFL first, second day guys. But Micah Ford and Cole Tabb each average over 4 yards per carry. Cal doesn't have the defensive line that Stanford has, the type of defensive line Stanford has seen the last 4 or 5 weeks. So I think Stanford can run the ball some against Cal. So I think those are for the Stanford side, running the football and getting after Songo-Polotele and make him a little less efficient and maybe make it produce a turnover or two. Those are the keys for the Cardinal.
John Platts, Stanford. I appreciate you joining us, JP. Thank you, man.
Thanks, John. Enjoy listening to the show, as always.
All right, there he goes. Big game taking place on Saturday. Stanford-Cal on the ACC Network. That'll never feel right. Stick around. Our big splash coming up.
Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Really good, action-packed first hour. I thought it was a great opening segment, great calls, great topic. If you missed it, grab a podcast. That's all I'm going to say. Really good interview with John Platts of Stanford, and that brings us to our big splash.
This is the one thing you absolutely need to know today.
Look at it. Where? Down there. Must be
the Big Splash.
Well, a little bit of a firing in the NBA. Lakers have fired Joey Buss and Jesse Buss from their office positions, their front office positions, effective immediately. Lakers dismissed much of their scouting department as well. When reached for comment, Lakers said the team have moved on. No further statement beyond that. Oh, there's always more to the story. Joey Buss was an alternate governor and vice president of research and development, and Jesse Buss was the Lakers' assistant general manager. Their older sister, Jeannie, will continue to serve as the Lakers' primary team governor for the foreseeable future. Those are her younger siblings. Jeannie's 64. Joey and Jesse are 41 and 37. Johnny and Jim are still around, too. The Buss family moving on out. And Lakers soon to be under officially new ownership. They sold majority ownership this June transaction. Under the transaction, Jeannie Buss is sticking around for a little while, but it appears as though the Lakers have pivoted. Will that make a difference on the court? We will see. Leave it here.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
It'll be Oregon and USC coming up on Saturday, Autzen Stadium, 12:30 kickoff. That's Elijah Scott with the cover there of Tracy Chapman's Fast Car. Joe Lohrig, special teams coach, University of Oregon. From a standpoint of fans and media, some games are bigger than others. For players, some games are bigger than others. As a coach, how do you sort of manage that? How do you manage, hey, you want to be locked in and you want to be have a lot of energy, but you don't want to overdo it? Joe Lohrig joining us. From campus, from his office at the University of Oregon, I'll just jump right in. I mean, you're in your office. Set the scene for us. For people who will never go to Joe Lohrig's office, what is the scene there?
Well, right now I'm looking outside at the construction of the Mo 2.0, our new indoor facility, which is going to be the nicest indoor facility in the country. It's going up fast, looking great. I see people out there working hard. But if you look inside, you're going to see a lot of pictures of my family and my favorite places. And most of that, if not all of that, includes fly fishing pictures. So pictures of my wife and I and my kids. We spend our lives in Montana, have for years. And so that's what you're going to see here. Now, not a lot of football stuff. We've kind of lived that, and it is what it is. But, yeah, you look around, you see three beautiful kids, a beautiful wife, and a bunch of pictures of Montana.
Don't you think you need, like, a nice river that runs just outside the office so you can just fly fish between meetings or fly fish, you know, on a whim?
Wouldn't that be amazing if you had, like, the Willamette and the McKenzie just flowing right in your backyard? Wouldn't that just be incredible? It's like a guy could go do that this afternoon if he wanted to, even, huh?
Do you have, like, do you keep your stuff? Is your gear, like, in the office, in the car? What do you, how close is it?
Yeah, it's I have a truck that I use just for fishing, and it's in the back of that. So, yeah, I can jump in and go. I typically do go every Thursday. I'm taking my wife on a lunch date today, so I'm not going today. But typically I go every Thursday. Coach Lanning sets the schedule or Thursdays about 2 o'clock, and we get out of here. And certainly before daylight savings kind of kills me. But before daylight savings, I usually head out to the McKenzie or the Willamette and just get a couple hours. And I find if you get away a little bit, it makes you a lot better for at least me. If I can get away from football and kind of clear my mind, I come back and I'm usually a lot more productive and a lot better.
Okay, you're a wildlife guy, so I got to share this story with you. The time change and the darkness, you know, I leave the studio, I'm driving home, I'm driving down a 2-lane road. It, you know, all of a sudden out of nowhere, flash, there's a deer who's running in front of me. I clip the deer, my car hits the deer, I feel terrible, I pull over. It is a good-sized deer that is laying in the road, and I feel awful. It's still alive, but it's kind of laying down its head. And, you know, I pull over. Another guy in a truck pulls over, and I'm feeling terrible, and I'm sitting there. I'm just ready to call, like, the non-emergency number, and the deer lifts its head up and then rises to its feet, and it runs off. Make me feel
I love it,
make
man.
Me feel better about this. Did that deer make it, like, you know, for like,
oh yeah, 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 he made it. There, he was in shock. You know, he got hit, he was in a little bit of shock, got up and took off, and he's out there living a good life right now, man.
Thank you. Thanks for making me feel better about
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. That's terrible. The best way to think about it.
I went home and I just my middle daughter was like, "What's wrong, Dad?" And I was like, "I hit a deer," and she was like, it's going to be okay. That deer's going to be okay. But I got to be honest with you. I drove that road the next morning and looking around, I was looking everywhere for that deer. Give me a brush with wildlife. Cause when you're out there and you're fly fishing, you must look up and see some amazing things.
Yeah. You see lots of amazing things. I'll tell you what, the one, I wish I had the picture with me right now. I'm looking at my frame here that, like, you know, goes through like the digital pictures there. But, I've been doing for 15 years straight. I went to Alaska, me and a couple other coaches, would go up to Alaska and go to a fly-in lodge. And there's literally pictures of me fishing with grizzly bears within 10 yards of you. Yeah. Me just walking right by you. It's just absolutely crazy. You know, the Katmai, the falls where you see the bears hunting the fish all the time, the famous pictures that you see all the time, fishing right there, like right where they're at. They won't mess with people, especially at that time of year, because there's so much salmon in the river.
Yeah.
And they don't want to get injured. So any kind of, like, there's never been a bear attack in Katmai National Park, even though it's the largest congregation of bears at that time of year eating salmon. There's never been one attack on people just because they're so focused on the fish that are in the river. So
what is that like?
I've had lots of lots of eagles and all kinds of cool stuff. That's a big part of it. A lot of people think that fishing is for fishing. For me, the fishing is really secondary. What it does is it carves out family time. It carves out time where you're not on your phone, where you're not listening to music, where it's just you outside. You know, I have a little drift boat, get into a boat and just spend some quality time unplugging from the world, which is more and more, at least in my world, it's more and more difficult to do.
Especially during the season. I mean, I find myself at this point of the season going, I could use, you know, I could be 20 yards from a grizzly bear and feel good about that. What is that like when you see?
No doubt.
What is that like when you see a bear catching a salmon? Because you're watching, like, you know, that's true wildlife. That's not going to a zoo.
No, it's amazing as you what you would think it is. It's just like you're in. I mean, after a while, like anything, you kind of get used to it. But it's like you're in awe. I mean, just that it again. I like grew up seeing the pictures of that and watching it, and it's just I don't know, something I don't take for granted. It's really cool, and I try to be really appreciative of all those kind of things, especially being a Northwest guy and living in Oregon. You know, that's the kind of stuff. Obviously, I'm saying Alaska for the bears, but just the outdoor stuff. Like, if you live here and don't embrace that, you're sure missing out, because there's a lot of really cool stuff around here for that.
Joe Lorig is our guest, assistant coach, University of Oregon. This is a big game. Media, fans, I'm sure players and coaches all go, okay, this is a big game with big implications. How do you keep your guys from maybe trying to do too much, trying to play with too much emotion? How do you sort of measure the, you know, the tempo and keep guys focused? But you want them playing with a lot of alacrity and enthusiasm, but you just don't want it to overcome them so they can't function.
Yeah, you know, I think it really goes into not what you do this week, but what you've done all the previous weeks. You know, it's what your approach is every single week of having, and I know people think it's kind of coach speak, but it's really not, of having that one-and-oh mentality. And, you know, if you beat USC, you don't get two wins in the win column, right? If you lose, you don't get two losses in the loss column. It's no different than the last opponent that you play or the next opponent that you play. And I really, you know, Coach Lanning really preaches that to us and really believe that in our core. You know, I know I certainly do. And I can tell you right now, we just walked off the practice field and Dante Moore, our quarterback, got up and spoke to the team. And that's exactly what he said. He said, you know, you can, he said, I've done it before in games where I made the moment bigger than it really was. And it affected me and caused me not to play as well as I can. This is just the same nameless, faceless opponent. We're going to play Oregon versus Oregon. And we want to walk out of here 1-0. And you know what? Regardless of what happens after that, we're going to line up the next week and we're going to be saying the same thing. And I think if you have that consistent mentality from the head coach down to the assistants and down to the players, it filters down and that's how they process and that's how they act.
You guys have had some big special teams moments this season, you know, with some fake punts and some kickoff things that have gone right for you. As a coach, when you know that is a possibility, if the kicker or the kicking team sees the right look, that, you know, the call is on, What is that like to watch it unfold?
Oh, that's awesome, man. You know, we execute those things over and over and over. And so when you actually see them come to fruition on the field, you know, I'm proud of the players. It's always about the players. I'm proud of their execution. You know, Coach Lanning, I'm lucky to work for a head coach that puts a lot of time and energy and allows us to play the best players on special teams. And you know, we really believe here that in there's such fine margins. You know, when you're playing USC or Penn State or whoever you're playing, there's such fine margins in the game that everybody's going to focus on offense and everybody's going to focus on defense, obviously. But a lot of people don't put the time and energy and resources necessary into their special teams. It's kind of a lost part of the game. And if you really pay attention, which, you know, I'm a special teams coordinator, of course I do, but if people really pay attention, it has a really, really big impact on every game. You know, one of the things that we do is we track what we call hidden yards in a game. And I think people would be shocked and amazed at how often, you know, we win a game and we had 80 more hidden yards or 100 more hidden yards. I'll give you an example. So say we punt the ball, right? And they get no return yards on their punt return, okay? And then say the next series they punt the ball and we get 11 yards on a return. Well, there's 11 yards that were just kind of hidden where we gained on them and without boring you or the fan, you know, the fans out there with any, all the different numbers. You can think about, okay, kickoff, if we gain five there and then, you know, it adds up. We're over a game. Oftentimes it's 80, 90, 100 yards that are hidden yardage where we've won that, right? And so think if you could add 80 to 100 yards to your offensive stats or subtract 80 to 100 from your defensive stats, which essentially that's what it is. It goes to one or the other, right? It just doesn't really show up in the stat sheet necessarily unless you track it. It has a major, major, major impact. And Coach Lanning recognizing that, I know our players have bought in and recognized that, and it definitely impacts the, it's going to impact the game one way or another. Either it's going to change the game in the right way or the wrong way for your team.
You mentioned, you know, you've got, Coach lets you have the best guys. You know, help us with that. Like, are there teams out there that you think, you know, they want to hold their best guys off because they're worried about injury or overuse, or what's the concern?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you got to have, you know, you got to be aligned with the head coach's beliefs and values. And you know, here it was very clear when I took the job, and I'd already worked with Coach Lanning, so I already knew. But it was very clear that every player other than O-line, D-line, and quarterbacks could start on two special teams. And so if a receiver's there, he can start on punt and kickoff return, or, you know, out of the big four, I'm talking punt, kickoff return, kickoff cover, and punt return. I can have anybody on the team start on two of those units. If it's going to be any more than two, then I go to Coach Lanning and we talk about it and make sure. We also every week, we on Sunday when we meet as a staff, I put up a chart of how many each player by position played in that game, how many special team snaps and how much they've played on the season. So with that being said, you know, we're not going to overutilize or underutilize players, but we're going to track it and make sure that it correlates with what they're playing on offense and defense as well. But yeah, there's people out there that won't play their best players on special teams. But you know what? If you're like me and you know who those people are, oftentimes when you watch it, they're not successful over time.
Joe Lorig.
They're just not.
Joe Lorig is with us, a special teams coach at University of Oregon. I was a punt returner for my community college team, but we went punt block on every single punt return. I was back there alone. They told me, hey, if you need to fair catch it. Otherwise, catch it and get what you can. You know, what are you looking for in a punt returner? What kind of mentality do you want from a guy back there?
Now, does that say something about your skills or about the coaching? Because if I don't have a very good returner, then I just go block every time. But if I have a really good returner, then I just call return every time. So I don't know. You might have to think about that.
I think they trusted me to catch the ball is what they said. What we're saying,
like, there you go.
We know you're okay back there, but if you get 11 yards, we're happy with it. So I think that was the mentality.
Now, what junior college did you go to? I went to a junior college.
De Anza in California.
Okay.
Yeah,
absolutely. Northern California. Yeah, I wish more junior college balls out here.
I know. And so, yeah, the Bay Area community colleges, like from San Francisco State to De Anza to West Valley and, you know, Diablo Valley, Foothill, there were some guys that went on and played, you know, at a high level. You know, you went to Western Oregon. That's where you eventually ended up. But, you know, why do you think the community colleges up here aren't as robust?
Yeah, so I went to Walla Walla Community College to start with, and then I transferred to Western Oregon. And really, community college football, I mean, I could tell you story after story after story of it saving guys' lives, mine included, literally. I was a lost young man and didn't have good grades. And lots of guys like me went to Walla Walla and were really saved and given another opportunity to, you know, and eventually got ourselves right, got our grades right, and were able to go to a four-year school. But, you know, I don't know. I think seems like funding is a big issue with things. You know, I'm not at that level to know what goes into those decisions. But then, you know, when somebody drops, it's easier for the next people to drop. And then when they drop, then there's it's harder to schedule and those kind of things. So I'm a huge, huge proponent of small college, community college, just because not everybody's going to play at Oregon. As a matter of fact, very few people are going to get that opportunity to play at a school like an Oregon or, you know, or in any big school like that. And so, you know, I was able to go to the Western Oregon Central Washington game last week, and I can tell you the purity of the game at that level, kids playing because they just love each other and love the game, and their parents were there. It's just really cool, and it really provides guys an opportunity where high school football doesn't have to be the end of something that a lot of guys love, and it really helps a lot of guys stay focused and stay on track as they work through college.
I love that. I also, I think, you know, maybe you need that. It's good for the soul to see people in it just for the love of the game, or maybe it have – you know, not a big TV contract attached to a game. All that stuff's great, but, you know, I think about that when I see the Big Sky and other conferences. I go, hey, there's still a place out here for kids that are just playing because they love to play, or D2, D3, NAIA, all those levels. What do you love about coaching? I can tell you care about kids, and I think in our last talk it really came through, but, you know, what do you love in your day-to-day?
Yeah, so it's really simple for me. You know, I never got into coaching for money or anything. I could have never even fathomed working at Oregon. People at Oregon were like heroes to me. There's no way I could ever even have dreamt about being here. I coach for one simple reason. I grew up with no dad, and my college coach, I think I said this last time, but my college coach ended up being the best man in my wedding. He's like my dad. He gets mad when I say like a dad. He likes me to say big brother because he doesn't want to seem that old. But he was like my dad. He taught me how to tie a tie. He taught me. I watched by the way he treated his wife, how to be a good husband. I watched by the way he raised his kids, how to be a good dad. Because I didn't have that. I had a wonderful mom, but I didn't have a father figure growing up that way. And so the impact that my coach had on me, I said, I want to have that impact on other people. You know, and so that's solely the reason that I got into it. Never thought I would be a Division I coach. My goal was to be a professor and a coach at Western Oregon. That was my entire goal in coaching. So, I was hoping if I could have just that impact that I had, that my coach had on me, on one kid, how amazing that would be. And I can tell you, I got a message this week from a player who played in the NFL just this week, literally. And from this state, and told me, hey, coach, just want to let you know, you changed my life. I love you. You had the impact you wanted to have. And so when you get things like that, you know, it makes it all worth it.
That's such a win. Such a win. All right. What do you see from USC on film when you look at them from a special teams perspective?
Yeah, you know, just what you'd think you'd see. I mean, they're super talented. So, you know, really good returners, really good kick returner. Their punt returner is also the receiver. Lemon, he's really, really good, number six. So explosive, dynamic athletes all over the place. You gotta make sure that you're containing, you know, those explosive players and you know, kind of tricky. I think probably everybody saw out there, they put their punter in the same number as the quarterback a couple weeks ago, Heward. And so he came in and had a really big kind of a pivotal play in their game against Northwestern. So a little bit of trickery there, but certainly creative, you know, which is, I would think, probably a staple of what Lincoln Riley does. And so we got our hands full, man, but our guys are up for the challenge. They're really excited about the opportunity, and looks like it's going to be nice weather here. I know Autzen will be loud, and it's going to be senior night here, so I'm super excited about it.
Is that poor form to do the jersey thing, or is all fair in love and special teams?
Honestly, I didn't really know the rule on it. So I didn't even know that it was illegal, to be honest, but we do always check it just because, I don't know, just for years and years, I always have who the punter is and who the backup punter is on my sheet. I'm not saying it couldn't happen to me, but, it's something we've been aware of. I think, again, anything that falls in the rules is legal to me, but it sounds like it would have been a penalty on the next punt is my understanding of it. If the guy had gone in and punted, but hey man, trying to get every edge you can get, and it didn't get called. So I get it.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is like when I once saw a team that, you know, they're running a player off and he stops and he kind of hides by the sideline. And to this day, Every time a player's running off the field, I'm watching from the press box, and I watch till they cross the line and go off the field. I mean, I've just been conditioned to make sure that guy gets off the field. Let me tell you,
I'm the same way, John. But you know that, and that is illegal. That's been deemed. But you know that happened to Oklahoma a few weeks ago. Yeah, and they I can't remember who they were playing, but they somebody scored on them because of that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they come out and tell you on Monday, well, we missed that, but because that's very clearly a rule. But I'm like you, because back in the day, we all did that.
Yes.
You know, you'd run the guy out. So the coach would act like you're yelling to get a guy off, and he'd run outside the numbers. We all did that one. Absolutely.
I'm watching that stuff, and then I'm always counting players. But you have to, as you know, now you got to look at USC. You got to look at the guy. Is it the right? Is that the punter? Is that the quarterback? You know, people in disguise. Joe Lorig is with us. All right, I appreciate you coming on. Obviously, you know, a lot of people in the state of Oregon connected to you because of your time here, being you know, homegrown, so to speak, and rooting for you. I want to ask you before I cut you loose. Like, you know, this is a business; it can be cutthroat. James Franklin, a guy that you coached with at Idaho State. You know, you see him at Penn State. You probably maybe talk to him before or after the game. Who knows? And then, you know, he's back. He's, you know, he's got another shot at Virginia Tech. You know, what do you make of this business in general? And do you stay in touch with guys that you have coached with in the past?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. James and I were texting yesterday. Yeah. He's a very close friend of mine. We didn't just work together. We were roommates at Idaho State. It was his first full-time job. My first full-time job. We moved, got us this little junky little apartment together and lived together for a year. And yeah, I absolutely talked to him last year, you know, before the Big Ten championship and this year before the game. And, you know, I think the business, it's a tough business, but it's what we all sign up for. We kind of all know what it is. I'm really excited for him to have the opportunity that he has, because he's an amazing coach and an amazing person. You know, I always say, like, how would I evaluate? I know all the stuff that happens behind the scenes, and I can tell you this. I would be very proud and happy to let my son play for James Franklin. Mm. No question. He is one of the good guys that does things the right way, treats kids the right way, treats people the right way, has a really good heart. And I think he's going to absolutely kill it at Virginia Tech. I really do. I think he's hungrier than he's ever been. You know, and sometimes being knocked down, it's just like anybody in life. When you get knocked down, it's not what happens to you. It's how you respond to it. Right. And I think that just made him more hungry and more excited. And I'm really excited to watch what he does. But as far as the industry, we all kind of know what we're signing up for, man. I never feel, just to be honest with you, sorry to be so long.
No, you're good.
I never feel that bad for the head coach, because, you know, he had a $50 million buyout.
Right.
It's all the people behind the scenes that no one thinks about. It's, you know, even the assistant coaches, people think, well, they make this money. Well, you know, a lot of assistant coaches' contracts are tied to the head coach. So as soon as he's not the head coach anymore, you don't actually have a contract.
Yeah.
That's very common in our business. The recruiting people, the, you know, the trainers, the equipment people, those people's jobs could all be in jeopardy, and they don't have $50 million to fall back on. So I never feel bad for the head coach, even though, you know, obviously they didn't succeed, or it's perceived they didn't succeed, but it's all the other people and families that are affected that I feel bad for. But again, we all knew when we got into this business, we all knew what we were signing up for. And if you don't win enough, that's what happens. And that's why we keep working and doing everything we can to win, man. We work as hard as we possibly can to make sure we're putting a good product on the field and make our fans proud.
Yeah, you had Bruce Barnum on that Idaho State staff.
Barney's a good friend. I listen to Barney's interviews with you every week,
man.
You do a great job.
He's had a tough year.
You know, he's exactly like he is on the radio in light. That's how if you walk in. If you went to dinner with him, that's exactly how he'd talk. Bruce is Bruce, and I love that about him.
I love it. All right, go enjoy your day, and I'll catch you down the road. Appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, I listen to you every day, John. I think you do a great job, and appreciate what you do for the Northwest, man.
Thanks, Joe. Take care, man.
All right. Bye. See ya.
There's Joe Lorig, special teams coach, assistant coach, University of Oregon, man of the world. What a really good interview. I hope you love that. Share it with a friend, a family member, and you know, it's interesting to get to know these guys as people. We've had a chance to do that with the interviews on this show over the years. I feel like you know Joe Lorig now, and every time you see a punt or a kickoff, and maybe you pay a little closer attention. I want you to leave it here. You got the Bald Face Truth statewide on the BFT Radio Network.
Back to the Bald Face Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
That was a very solid, enjoyable interview with Joe Lorig, University of Oregon special teams coach, We did a very similar interview with him a year ago, in which he talked a lot about his upbringing and certainly his coaching and why he got into the profession. But really good stuff there with Joe Lohrig. I encourage you, if you listen to that interview and you loved it, share it with somebody. You can get the podcast at Apple Podcasts. If you've got an iPhone, just make sure it's the Purple Podcast app and make sure you search for John Canzano, Bald Face Truth. And those interviews will pop right up for you and you can share them. They're very easy to share using the technology. But really good stuff from Joe Lohrig. I like him. I like what he's about. And I think it's great for the rest of us to get an insight into kind of some of the coaches. Sometimes you just think of the coaching staff, using air quotes here, the coaching staff at Oregon. Yeah, I think it's cool to get a peek into, like, who are these people? What are they about? And the fact that he's so candid in talking about how, you know, there was a coach in his life that saved him, and you know, he wants to be that person for somebody else, kind of what it's all about, you know, it is. In the end, I've said this frequently, your job doesn't love you. It does not. You may think it loves you. It does not love you. They will step over your cold body. If you drop dead, they will step right over you to the next person. Your job is not there to love you and hug you back. Nobody on their deathbed has ever said, I wish I would have worked one more day. And it's why, even in this business, I'll be honest with you, I've worked with people who take themselves too seriously. I have worked with people who don't really get what we're trying to do on the show. That interview is part of what we're trying to do on the show. There is a depth to the interviews that I don't think you're getting elsewhere. And I have often said, like, I recently went on a rant about how, like, you know, I'm not interested in the box score. I'm not interested in the play-by-play of the game. I'm not going to be there at the game tweeting play-by-play, and I'm not going to give you on this show a play-by-play. I leave a very loose format because I like to have the kind of conversation we had in the opening segment. And I'll be honest with you, I've even had people that are part of the staff on this radio show who don't understand what we're trying to do. And it makes me, it makes me want to bring them along and say, hey, look, let's think about this. Anybody who really cares about the game is watching the game, knows what happened, and knows the score. They're not tuning in here to get the play-by-play of the second quarter. Blazers last night, tremendous comeback in the fourth quarter. And a tremendous breakdown at the end of the game, and the Chicago Bulls beat them with a three. Steven, you saw it. And if you're a Blazer fan, you already heard about it. And we can talk about, like, you know, how when you don't have depth and when you don't have experience, you can lose in a variety of ways. You get blown out one night and you get your heart broken the next night despite a rousing fourth quarter comeback. You have a breakdown. Those are the things that plague teams that are inconsistent. They plague teams that are not on it. And, yeah, I guess we could break down that play and talk about it inside out. But the truth of the matter is I'm more interested in the psychology of it. I'm interested in what happens to Tiago Splitter. I'm interested in whether or not the Blazers roster has run out of gas. I'm interested in, you know, the psychology of a fan base that is enduring a change of regime. And I would say to anybody who, like, would tune into the show and go, oh, you know, you don't talk about the nuts and bolts of sports and the games, and I want to know what happened with the backup left tackle in the second quarter, I would just say politely to that person, this show's probably not for you. But I would ask you, like, listen to that Joe Lohrig interview. And if your eyes aren't opened by listening to Joe Lohrig talk about how he was lost as a kid in high school, I can't help you. I can't help you. And I can't overstate this. Like, I've had people who are part of the show who sit around listening to the show because they have a job at the station who don't understand what the show is about. And I just wonder, I always look at those people and I'm like, why are you here? Why are you even here if you don't get what we're doing and you don't want to be part of what we're doing, just move along, get out of the way. You know, like I'm sure that exists in any industry. You know, I have, in fact, I'll bring up the waste management industry because I think it's an interesting one. Recently, the garbage company that services our neighborhood sent out a notice saying, you can't put, we don't want you to put bags in the recycling. They don't want bags in the recycling. And I'm sure there's a reason, a really good reason, why the waste management company doesn't want bags in the recycling. And yet, I've got neighbors who were adamant going, it's a recyclable bag. I don't understand why it's a recyclable bag. And I'm like, you know, maybe you don't really understand what is happening on the other end, the function of the other end. This is not nuts and bolts. Maybe it's a 20,000-foot view thing. Maybe there's some technology on their end where having things in a bunch of bags causes problems on their end. Just take it out of the damn bag. What are we talking about here? Why are we even talking about this? If you don't get it, you don't get it in the end. Stephen, did you hear the interview with Joe Lorig? I loved it. It's part of why I love doing this show. It might be the reason why I love doing this show, is that we can have the conversation like we had in the opening segment, very organic, segue into talking about great coaches and socioeconomic backgrounds and why it is that affluent kids who get into club sports and club teams or have distinct advantages over maybe some kids that don't have access to that. And then here comes Joe Lorig an hour later saying, I was a lost kid and I went to community college and, you know, I found a coach who believed in me, who poured into me and probably saved my life. And he talks about that with such conviction. That's why I'm here.
And it could be one of those things we talked about earlier. Like, no, maybe nobody knew that, you know, Joe Lorig was going through these type of things, and his coach got it out of him one day, and his coach is like, look, man, I got you. Like, you know, and it builds that trust and becomes a lifelong, more than a friendship, like, you know, a family member, basically. As he said, like, he was a father figure, best man at his wedding. Like, that's the type of stuff that you do love to hear. And then you love to hear the success that, you know, Coach Lorig has had in his career as well. Like, now he's at the University of Oregon. Like, he's doing great things in his life and he wants to give back. And I think that's the beautiful thing about sports, is that not only it can give you a lot of things, but it can help you give back to the next generation and continue going on. And it makes you want to root for guys like that going forward. When you learn about them, like, I think Dan Lanning is the same thing. Like, you can, you know, I hear Dan Lanning do his press conferences and, you know, he comes across as a guy who's very intense, a guy who's very short with his answers. But then you get him on your show, John, and you get him to open up about certain things. And you're like, man, like, I can really relate with this guy. Like, this is a guy that I can actually go out and root for. And so I'm
more interested in that.
Right. And I think it puts him on a whole new level where it's not like, oh, man, like, he's the boss. Like, he's the head football coach. Like, he's the almighty God. Like, no, like, he's a normal dude just like you and me. But he just happens to be a really good football coach, and he coaches at Oregon. And I think it puts him on a human level. And I think that last interview is a great example of that as well. Like, Joe Lorig is a guy that, look, man, like, he's gone through a lot in his life, and now look where he is. And I think it can prove out to be anything. Anybody else can do that, too.
I got a text during the Joe Lorig interview from Joe Lorig's father-in-law, who was like, I love this interview. I got another text from an area college coach who said, this is a, what was the word he used? It was a very enjoyable interview to listen to. I that's what we're after here in part. And some people, again, in the world of radio, I'm not one of these people that thinks, like, people will talk about industries that are dying. Like, they'll say the newspaper industry is dying, and it's true. There are some papers that are dying. I don't think that the news industry is dying. I think it has pivoted in some ways. I can show you the analytics at johnconzano.com. There's never been more people reading me than there are right now. But the mechanism has shifted. Not reading me in a newspaper. They're reading me on their mobile device. They're reading me online. They're receiving, you know, my writing every day in real time. Like, the minute I file it, bam, it's in your email inbox. You can read it. Here you go. You can, you know, share it and read it, but you can actually hit reply. You're actually in a conversation with me when you hit reply, because I get it and I reply back. And so we're in this different kind of communication. I feel like this spoken word radio thing that started, you know, the day finally you could get an AM or an FM signal out and somebody said, oh, you know, here's a good idea. We'll put music on, or we'll put somebody on having a conversation for 3 hours. And, oh, we could take phone calls now and look at the technology. Certainly there have been technological advances, but I think the biggest advancement has been the conversation that people are having. And it is a one-on-one conversation, or in this case with Joe Lorigan and I talking, it's he and I talking and people listening. But I think there are a lot of people out there that could listen to that interview and draw something from it. And maybe your life is enriched a little bit, or maybe you're a little smarter, or maybe you feel or you think about something in a different way. And I think that's really what I'm after. And it really, it doesn't frustrate me, because there are some people, I'm just going to be honest with you, there's some people who are going to send me a note and be like, oh, you're not talking enough about the games. You're not talking about the NFL. You're not talking about the Blazers game last night. You didn't talk about. And I'm like, hey, man, maybe this isn't for you. Maybe this show is not for you. And the weirdest thing is when you get somebody who works on the show, who wants to sit around in the background and be like, ah, like almost like they're a member of the team. You're in the locker room, but they're stewing in the corner because they don't agree with the philosophy of the head coach, and they don't like the quarterback, and they're just stewing and stewing. And I'm like, why would you ever spend your time doing that? Why, as a listener, if you didn't enjoy what you were listening to and find it enriching, why would you stick around? You shouldn't. You shouldn't. And here's the other thing. I would rather have fewer listeners who are more highly engaged, who really feel deeply connected to the show. And I do think that's the case with this show. I think the diehard listeners are deeply connected with the show. I think I would rather have that than have, I don't want everybody like just mildly engaged. That's not what I'm after. I'm after a real conversation. Punch and Audio is coming up. Then the 5 at 5. You got the BFT. I want you to leave it here.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I appreciate everybody who makes this radio show part of their day. If you make it part of your day, you get it. Not everybody gets it. Not everybody gets it. We are going to play Punch It Audio. We have the 5 at 5 coming up top of the hour. We also have Thursday Night Football. I was trying to remember what day it was. You ever do that? You know, on Monday, I almost made the mistake of saying it was Thursday. I don't have a normal life. Like, I'm weird. I have, like, I'm working on a Saturday. I'm working on a Sunday. Everybody else, like, don't take it for granted that you have a beginning and an end to your work week. It messes with me. Like, there are days where I'm like, it's Thursday.
I, in fact, said that to someone yesterday. I said, oh, yeah, man, it's Monday today. And they're like, it's Wednesday, man. I'm like, oh, it is? I don't know, man. I'm out.
I'm not a normal person. And I envy you if you are. If you're normal, don't take it for granted. All right, let's do it. Let's play some Punch It Audio.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio.
Presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
Jason Kelce says Eagles players should be grateful for Jalen Hurts. Here's Kelce.
People might not like playing with Jalen Hurts. I bet everybody likes winning a Super Bowl.
Yeah.
I bet everybody likes winning football games. I can tell you this. I've been on losing football games. It is miserable. And I don't think that that's true on a large scale. I think a lot of this is overblown. And I think that everybody has their motivations and whatever. I think that at the end of the day, this team is very good. It is to everybody's best interest to be a unified front, especially when you have magic bottled up, when you've just come off of appearing in two Super Bowls over the last 3 years. You've won one of them. You have amazing talent. It's everybody's best interest in that organization to be like, hey, actually, we're really good. We probably shouldn't focus on maybe what upsets us about each other as much, and maybe probably should focus out on what makes all of us so freaking great.
Eagles quarterback Jalen Hurts says he was not startled by recent reports of frustration inside the organization directed toward him. He said it comes with the territory. Puts his energy and focus on going out there trying to help his team win. DeSean Jackson, meanwhile, hinting at the issues in the locker room, says something else is going on. You can tell something else is going on. Retired Eagles player says, you know, there's something out there. There's a relationship issue that is going on. I think this is just, it's that time of year. Everybody's been cooped up. These teams are getting to the point where frustration's boiling over. But by the way, the Eagles are having problems. Is it 8-2 team? They got a locker room issue?
Since when was winning not enough? You know?
Yeah.
Like, they've gone to two of the last three Super Bowls. They won a Super Bowl, and they're still mad at everybody? Yeah. Come on now.
Meanwhile, Chiefs special teams coordinator Jake Taub, he is reacting to the president's criticism of the kickoff rules, saying that they ruined football.
President criticized the new kickoff rules when he was at the Washington game. What's your reaction?
He doesn't even know what he's looking at. You know, he has no idea what's going on with the kickoff rule. So, I mean, I take that for what it's worth. I hope he hears it.
I guess the Chiefs aren't going to the White House right now. No reason, no idea what is going on. J.J. McCarthy, meanwhile, says he's had to learn what it is to be an NFL quarterback.
Coming in here, I was taught how to play quarterback in a very different way. And that's, you know, expected going into the league, going into any new team, any new system. But at the end of the day, you know, it was really just the injuries that I felt like, you know, kind of took away all those reps and the constant repetition to make those a habit and make them concrete, like KO talks about. But, yeah, I feel like, you know, it's just the repetitions. You know, how many times could I go home and every time I take the dogs out, I'm getting, you know, 10 drops each time. Little things like that where you just keep building the reps.
Getting reps, learning it. I mean, you know, there's the whole idea that you need 5,000 hours or 10,000 hours to master something. Learn to play the guitar in just 21 days.
What?
Like, you need a certain mastery. I do think it takes time, and the problem is a lot of these teams don't have time. They throw a quarterback in there.
What did you make of him saying he got taught a different way? Harbaugh was his coach. Jim Harbaugh was his head football coach at Michigan. He said, look, I was taught a different way, and now I'm coming to the Vikings, and it's completely different. What do you make of that?
I think some of that can be attributed to the idea that there's a difference between college and the NFL, but think about the role he played on that Michigan team. I was there when Michigan beat Washington for the national championship. It wasn't J.J. McCarthy throwing the ball. He was handing the ball off, Stephen. He wasn't being called on. He was, you know, be a game manager. Don't make a mistake.
He just had to turn around and give it to the running back.
Turn around and hand it to that guy that is going to carry us to the championship. Meanwhile, is Shedeur Sanders the guy? He says he feels like he is. He'll get a start against the Raiders this weekend.
Yeah, for instance, I know our fans have a lot of expectations and hope. And I would be doing a disservice to myself and disservice to the organization if I didn't feel like I am the guy. I did everything I need to. I'm doing everything I need to prepare to be the best version of myself as possible. With the circumstances, everything got to be sped up, and that's great. You know, I like pressure in life. I'm just excited for everything, so, you know, I feel like I'm the guy, I know I'm the guy, but, you know, you just have to be able to see. The game got to speak.
Game's got to speak. He's got a good, I think, nice, gentle first start against the Raiders, but he's also suiting up for the Cleveland Browns. This is not going to be easy for Shedeur. Meanwhile, Pete Thamel, ESPN, says he thinks Oregon is the more talented team. Oregon playing USC Saturday, 12:30. Here's Thamel.
I just think Oregon's more talented, man. I just think they're better. There'll be good quarterback play there. Oregon has better quarterback play. Holistic skill. I mean, no one's Mekhi Lemon, right? But, like, holistic skill, mm-hmm. I think depth of skill, tight ends, et cetera. I think Oregon is just a little bit higher class. So I'm going to take the Ducks. But I think this will be a very good, close game and kind of fun, right? Like, it's fun to have USC mm-hmm. back playing big games like this.
Can USC play this game close? That has become the question to ask. I disagree with Thamel. I also disagree with Bud Elliott, who thinks USC is going to keep it close. I think Oregon's going to win this game by double digits, but here's Bud.
I am going to go ahead and take the 10 with USC.
I think this is the second best passing attack, or maybe the first, depending, that Oregon's seen this year, and by a lot, right? Like they faced Iowa, can't throw. You know, all the other teams they've played except for Indiana can't throw. And Indiana threw it on pretty okay. So I do think that USC will be able to score a little bit. I'm going to go ahead and take the 10 with USC.
I think they'll score a little bit, too. I just don't think scoring a little bit is going to be enough to stay with Oregon's run game. I think Oregon is going to have success on the ground. Ducks favored by 9.5 or 10, depending on where you see it. But I think it lines up all kinds of wrong for USC. And I feel like I'm on an island with this one. Ducks are at home. Ducks will be locked in. I expect Oregon's running game to have a big day. Weather looks like it's going to be fine. But give me Oregon to win. Give me Oregon to cover. I think it's like 38-21. I have Oregon winning by 17. Steven, how do you see it?
I think USC keeps this one close. I think it's a three-point ball game. It's coming down right to the wire. I would say about 31-28, somewhere around in there. I think USC will be able to score a little bit. And I do question Will Stein's ability to just say, look, let's run the football on these guys every single time. Because I think if they do that, then you're right. I think Oregon can run all over them. But I think they might try to get a little cute. And might get a little bit of a problem there. And I think, here's the thing, Oregon's the number one pass defense in the nation, John, but they, as Bud said, they face nobody good that can throw the football. USC can throw the football, so I think they'll be able to score, and I think this is close. I actually think USC is pretty live to win this one.
I don't think so at all, but let's see how it goes down. I think it's Oregon big. Jake Butt says Oregon's got to stop the pass.
Right now, Oregon has the number one ranked passing defense in college football. You'd say that is good because it is good, but you start to peel back the layers a little bit and look at the opponents Oregon has faced this year. Rutgers is 22nd in passing offense. That's the best passing offense they've faced. Indiana, number 38. Oregon State, number 74. None of their other opponents are inside the top 100 in passing offense.
Shocking.
And USC is the 10th best passing offense, as if you need statistics to understand how dangerous they are. That is the big matchup here. Brandon Finney Jr. is a true freshman, number 4 for Oregon. I think he's playing like an All-American. Not a freshman All-American, like a true All-American. Remember, he had that key pick 6 against Indiana. I cannot wait to see what they do with Brandon Finney Jr. against Mekhi Lemon and Jacoby Lane. That secondary needs to play their best game of the season.
Yeah, they need to play like Notre Dame played. I mean, Notre Dame beat USC by 10. You look around and you say, how did USC do it? Well, they did it against Michigan State and Purdue and Nebraska and Northwestern, Iowa. Now they get Oregon. I think it's going to be a big test for Lincoln Riley. I like the Ducks. You tell me on social media who you like and stick around.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Well, we got the 5 at 5 leading us right into Thursday night football here on the bald-faced truth. Big Thursday night football game. They're all big. The NFL, we talked about this on Monday. I don't care who's playing. Every NFL game. And, Steven, you think it's gambling. You think that's what it is?
I think a lot of it is. I think it's, it's so easy to gamble now. And it's just like, hey, there's an NFL game. I think football's a lot more easier to bet on than basketball. So,
I think
gambling has a lot to do with it.
Well, let's do it. We've got the 5 biggest stories in sports.
The 5 at 5. Number 1.
Well, speaking of football and that Monday night game that we talked about a little bit earlier this week between the Raiders and the Cowboys, there's some information that has come out. So if you noticed in that game, CeeDee Lamb and George Pickens, the two star receivers for the Cowboys, they were benched for the very first drive of that game between the Cowboys and the Raiders. It has now come out why they, in fact, were benched for that first drive. CeeDee Lamb and George Pickens, they missed curfew before the game in Las Vegas as the two were having dinner and a few drinks at the Red Rock Casino and were having a lot of fun at the casino. So there was reports that Lamb was out throwing up at the casino. People saw him. He denied that report. And the quote that CeeDee Lamb had was, he said it was very disrespectful and that Lamb knows how to hold his own liquor, that he wouldn't be throwing up in front of people. But that's the reason why they were benched for the first game, John. I'm surprised this doesn't happen more with Vegas. Like, you come in, you know, you're there for the weekend. Like, they're playing on Monday night, so they have a Saturday and a Sunday to have fun in Vegas. But
it's a lot of time.
Yes. I mean, The longest I can do in Vegas is like 4 days. Like, I've been there for the NCAA tournament round one, like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. That Sunday, man, I am dragging anyways. Like, that's a long time. But if you're there and you got all that money, you're a football player, you're getting ready to play. I mean, I'm surprised this doesn't happen more often. But Lamb and Pickens, they did end up dominating the game, and the Cowboys crushed the Raiders on Monday night.
Cowboys did fine. I wonder if the Raiders thought that would be an advantage, right? The team visiting teams right, coming to town. And in this case, maybe they need to just be a little better.
Number two.
The college game is down in Eugene this week for the Oregon-USC game, and the guest picker has been announced. It's not Sabrina. Sabrina has been at the last two times. It will be the GOAT, Marcus Mariota, former Oregon quarterback, former Heisman Trophy winner. He will be the guest picker for college game day. Also down in Eugene is Justin Herbert and his pop star girlfriend, Madison Beer. They were seen in Eugene this week walking around. Chargers do have a bye week, so maybe Herbert and Mariota can do a little thing on college game day and have the popular Madison Beer on there as well. A lot of star studs down in Eugene for college game day this weekend.
Yeah, so it's Mariota making the picks?
Mariota's making the picks, but Herbert and Beer were just seen down there walking around.
Yeah, because she started the whole thing by tweeting out a picture of the mountains they were flying over. Were they flying over Mount Hood or something, you know? I don't know where they were.
I don't know. I actually didn't see her tweets or anything.
Must have been, because they must have been leaving the Portland metropolitan area and flying. I don't know.
Apparently, she's a big deal, though.
Forgive me.
I don't know anything about her.
All right. I'm sure that this is showing our... she's a singer and a songwriter.
Yeah, she's a pop star.
Pop star. What does she sing?
I don't know. She's a good-looking 26-year-old woman. That's what she is that I know about.
All right. Are we on to three now?
We are.
All right.
Number three.
You said good looking.
Hey. I mean, I can't.
You sounded like... she a co-ed? You sounded like it.
Oh, sounded like an old man right there.
Yeah, I
also didn't
she's
want...
good looking.
I didn't want to sound like a creepy old man. That's the thing. Yeah. You go, creepy old man or just old man. So,
you just sounded older.
Well, thank you.
I can remember one time I was at my grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary party, and this older gentleman in his 80s leaned into myself and another guy who was a college friend of mine. We were at the party together. He said, how are the co-eds this year? And I thought that just channeled that in that moment. All right, number three.
Baylor Athletic Director Mac Rhodes, he officially resigned today, a week after he took a leave of absence for personal reasons. Of course, Rhodes had to step down as being the chairman of the College Football Playoff Selection Committee because of this investigation. Now, Linda Livingstone, the school's president, sent in a letter today that Rhodes had informed her of his decision to step away from his Baylor position. Rhodes, after he took his leave of absence, the school said it was investigating unspecified allegations against him. The status of that investigation is still ongoing, but was not immediately clear after he left the job. The school did not give any further details of why Rhodes resigned from his position. They said it did not involve Title IX student athlete welfare or NCAA rule violations and did not involve the football program. But Mac Rhodes, I think for me, a bigger scale for the college football playoff, maybe they should get away from having athletic directors involved with the CFP selection committee. That's just me. I feel like there's just too many problems that go with this. If you get other people that are involved, it may be a bit different. But like, this is a terrible look, I think, for the CFP committee as well for Mac Rhodes and Baylor.
I think there are some people that are speculating what it's about. It's, you know, it's a personal matter with Mac Rhodes. But, man, it was just like, feels like it was like a week ago that he was out there kind of justifying the picks. And now he's out of a job and they've got a new person in charge of being the chair of the selection committee. Keep an eye. Like, Baylor's going to have to make a hire here, right? They're going to need an athletic director. You heard it here first. Keep an eye on Jeremiah Dickey, the Boise State athletic director. He was on that athletic department staff at Baylor. I think Dickey will be a candidate. I think others will be candidates, but I think he's going to be a candidate.
But going back to the CFP, like, how can anybody take anything seriously that they're saying, knowing that like their committee chairman is out in like a week span? Like, people are already going to complain already about the rankings, but now you're like, oh, this guy's not even involved, but he was the main guy. Like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, and I think I agree with you too with the idea of like maybe the AD shouldn't be the go-to on this. You know, I'm left kind of thinking
they got enough on their plate.
The ADs are busy. There's a definite conflict of interest for some of these athletic directors who have bonuses in their contracts that are tied to getting to the playoff. I mean, why not just have sitting head coaches on there? Oh, we can't because the coaches, yeah, there's a conflict of interest.
Number four.
Well, the NBA is always full of drama, but the actual product this year has been really good, whether it's the pace of play, whether it's the young players, I don't know, but NBA games shown on NBC, Peacock, Amazon Prime Video, and ESPN have drawn more than 60 million viewers through the first month of the regular season, and that is the highest opening total in the last 15 years for the NBA, while NBA content has commanded more than 30 billion views across social media platforms. That's up. That's a record for this point in any season. Also, sales of merchandise has gone up 20% on NBAstore.com, and they said it's because it's the next generation of stars like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Cooper Flagg, Luka Doncic, Wemby, all those guys. No LeBron, no Curry. I find it interesting that the NBA, you know, they're kind of going away from the older guys and going into the younger generation a little bit more, and they're getting more of a viewership. I don't know if that's a coincidence or not, but NBA League Pass subscriptions has gone up 10%, and the time spent viewing has gone up 8%. If you watch ESPN, all they do is talk about LeBron. All they do is talk about this. Maybe they should start focusing not on LeBron and focusing on some of the younger guys, and people will watch the product a little more.
Why do I feel like I'm being scammed by these figures? You know what I mean? Like, why don't I trust it all the way?
Well, because everything's always a record now. That's what I found. This is the most watched game ever. This is the most watched program ever. Like, they're not going to come and say, this is a terribly watched game.
Yeah, it was okay.
It was fine. You know?
Are we on to number five now?
We are.
Number five.
I knew that. I just asked to be polite.
I know you did. Well, it is Thursday Night Football, and it is the Buffalo Bills, who looked good last week against the Bucs. They dominated the Bucs with their offense. They're taking on the Texans down in Houston. Houston, the Texans, they are a 5.5-point home underdog on Thursday Night Football this week, John. This is why we care. We're going to gamble on this game. If I'm going to watch it, I'm going to be gambling on it. So who do you like? Who should I put my money on?
I'm not doing that.
Okay.
I'm not telling people how to wager their money.
Josh Allen's never lost on Thursday night, by the way.
I'll give my picks, but I'm not going to tell you who to put money on. I would go with Josh Allen.
Me too.
You know what I started doing with my college picks? Because I was having a hard time this year. Normally, in the prior 2 years, I was picking at about 55 to 58% winners against the spread. I was having an unbelievable sort of run. And then this season, I had the hardest time, and I kept running into these cases where these teams that they have no common opponents. I was trying to figure out who's good, who's not good. And what I started doing last week is I said, I'm just going to pick the team I trust more. Who do I trust? And I went 8-6 against the spread and 10-4 straight up. Just with that, like, who do you trust? So I did it again today. The picks are out at johnconzano.com if you want to see them. I went with who I trusted. So go with who you trust. Because you don't want to have your money on a suppose, well, I think this, that.
That's why it sounds like you like Dane Lanning and the Ducks this week.
I do. Yeah, I don't trust Lincoln Riley. We're going to dive deep into it on tomorrow's show. Oregon USC, it'll be a bonanza. If you missed the Joe Lorig interview at 4 o'clock today, grab the podcast of it. John Platt's Stanford radio broadcaster on football and basketball is fantastic, talking about the big game. It's been a great show. The Bald-Faced Truth, not here for a long time, just a good time. Have a great Thursday night, everybody.